Ray Kaplan from the Kaplan Law Firm joins us. Hi, Ray.
Hey, John. Big day today.
Were you surprised by today's Supreme Court ruling on student debt?
You know, I wasn't surprised. I was, you know, at first, they issued the first ruling on the other case, the taxpayer case, stating that those taxpayers didn't have standing. And I thought for a second that the loan forgiveness program was going to win. And I kind of was more shocked about that. But then they went on to decide the second case, which was the Mohila one, decided that they did have standing, and then went on to decide, of course, that the opinion that the Biden administration overstepped their authority by issuing this loan forgiveness program through executive order. So I wasn't that surprised. And also, the last few nights, I've been going back over the history of this whole thing. You know, we've been talking about this for, you know, really over a year now. And I was looking at some of the comments that Biden made, even in a 60 Minutes interview. I think this was in September of 2022, where he said, essentially, of course, we cannot do loan forgiveness via executive order. That would be unconstitutional. And there were some other comments made by the former Speaker of the House and some other. So there did seem to be a consensus that this would be kind of a crazy notion and kind of a long shot in the first place. But then, yeah, I think people got so excited about it that we kind of lost track of that.
I saw a headline just a moment ago on my screen. It might have been from News Nation, but that the Supreme Court used a Nancy Pelosi quote in writing their decision about this. I'm not sure they need to defer to anybody but the Constitution, but that's just part of their opinion that they wrote.
Correct. Right.
Is there,
and
without getting down too into the weeds about standing and the machinations of all of this, the president then cannot, by executive order, forgive $10,000 or $20,000 of student loans. But the Congress could, and the president could pass that, correct?
Absolutely. And so I think that's something that's really important to remember here as we, you know, when we talk about these things, it's not really a decision on the merits of student loan forgiveness, because
right. That
is very debatable. And I think the problem was that the president was actually put in kind of a bad position here. I think there was knowledge that it was going to be very difficult to get student loan forgiveness the way they wanted it, to get it to pass Congress. And so they kind of just tried to bypass Congress, who holds the purse, to do this forgiveness via executive order, even though it exceeded executive authority. And the idea here is that it's not so much what you're doing as how you're doing it. So if you want to go through Congress and the Senate and debate this and pass student loan forgiveness, and the bill passes Congress, which there have been larger loan forgiveness statutes that have passed. For example, the public service loan forgiveness is a huge loan forgiveness statute. That statute passed, and it's not, you know, ever up for debate. So they can definitely pass a law that would give people loan forgiveness relief. It's just the issue is, can you do it via executive order? And the court ruled today that you cannot.
Right. The president would probably sign something like that were it to cross his desk, and the Senate might actually do it. That's close, but the Senate might do it. But I can't imagine it going through this version of the House of Representatives. Maybe that's something to consider if you want to make sure it doesn't go through. Vote Republican. If you want to give student loan forgiveness a chance, then you vote Democrat. But at least there's that avenue, however improbable it seems right now. What happens now, Ray? When do I have to start paying on my student loan again?
Yeah, so now student loans will start accruing interest again in September, and payments are due again in October. There are still lots of good relief programs out there, and we still have the normal statute dealing with federal student loans that we deal with all the time. But there are some other executive orders that have not been up for debate, which allow people who are in default to get out of default and to get that default removed from their credit report. And then, of course, there are the many income-based repayment plans and other payment plans that can lower your payments. We also have the Biden executive order that was not affected by the ruling today, which allows people to get their loans much closer to forgiveness. and of course, good old public service loan forgiveness. There's also private service, private sector loan forgiveness. So there are still lots of really good options to deal with federal loans. So I don't want people to panic. And even if you don't have federal loans, if you have private loans, there are some really good options available, like debt settlement, even, you know, possibly getting them knocked out in a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13. So there are a lot of really good options.
The big one, the public loan service forgiveness, is if you work 10 years and you haven't missed a payment, then the balance is then forgiven, correct?
Correct. And I mean, for some people, the payments, even if the payments were extremely low, as long as you were working in the public sector, there is this executive order that even if you weren't making a payment while you were employed in the public sector, we can get those months to qualify. So there's a lot of good stuff out there right now where you might not have qualified before. You actually might qualify now.
Ray Kaplan's joining us. She's the debt relief attorney specializing in student loans. Financialrelief.com is her website. You may have just now heard that the Supreme Court has ruled that in the Mohila case, they did have standing and that student debt must be forgiven. The president cannot, by executive order, forgive it. I didn't think they would have standing based on my reading and our conversations, based on what the justices themselves said during oral arguments. But you've got to start paying them. Interest starts accruing in September. You have to start paying your loans in October. Will we get a notice in the mail, or how do we haven't done it for over 3 years, Ray? What how do you do that anymore?
Oh, yeah. So notices have already started to go out, and there's a lot of panic. I want listeners to know not to panic. Even if you get a letter where the quoted amount that you're supposed to pay seems outrageously high, it is likely incorrect. So call us. We can help you with that. Make sure you're in the lowest payment plan. Or you still probably have forbearance options. So if you need a little bit more time, you do have statutory forbearance options available. So there are a lot of ways to even get you more time and get things, you know, under control. So don't worry about it. Don't panic. And likely the letter that you're going to be receiving is going to have an incorrect payment amount from your servicer. Still don't panic. And also your servicer might have changed, because a lot of the servicers that service federal loans have left the industry. So Fed loan servicing is gone. Navient no longer services direct federal loans, but they service FEL, F-F-E-L, federal student loans only. So there are some changes to the landscape, and it might be a little confusing until things settle down.
One quick question for you. What happens to people who received a letter of forgiveness from Pell loans with a P?
Pell, there is no such thing as Pell loans. There are Pell grants. Pell grants do not have to be paid back.
Ray, you read the Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action. You listened to some of the oral arguments. What's your thought about what happened yesterday?
I sure did. And I have to say, my opinion kind of changed on this, because I've always thought that your race should play a role in determining whether or not you're a qualified candidate, in as much as that it's part of your experience. However, there is a one paragraph in the opinion where the court was discussing how the court has permitted race-based college admissions only within the confines of narrow restrictions. I'm reading directly from the opinion. Such admissions programs must comply with strict scrutiny, may never use race as a stereotype or negative, and must at some point end. That was the precedent from the previous case, which is called the Grutter case. And the respondents' admission systems, they held fail on each of these criteria and therefore must be invalidated under the Equal Protection Clause. So basically what the court held is that it's not that, as you were saying earlier, that race cannot be considered at all in terms of if it's, you know, in the applicant's essay or it's a part of their story. It's just that, as we've been talking about, it's not a box that you check that automatically gives you a leg up, because the reality is that living in the United States today, we actually have come a long way. And the fact that you are part of a minority does not necessarily mean that you have overcome oppression. There are plenty of minorities who are in middle class and the upper middle class who've gone to elite private schools, and you really can't put them in the same category as a minority coming from a lower income public school from a disadvantaged neighborhood. Those are not the same thing. And so I think it might actually be better to kind of drill down and treat individual applicants and take a look holistically at their experience and their qualifications to get into school, rather than just, you know, kind of checking a box and automatically giving somebody a leg up just based on race, which I think we kind of can all agree is something that has positives, but a lot of negatives, and probably is ultimately, at least under this case, unconstitutional.
I think we would also agree that if you had a kid from an affluent family, went to a good school, had all the advantages of modern America, and he's black, and you had the identical kid who is white, their experiences are different. And maybe the color of the skin of the black kid is a bit of a detriment in life. But I see your point that perhaps if we were going to give legs up to disadvantaged people, a white kid from a very poor circumstance should maybe be considered disadvantaged. Where's the box for that kid? And the Supreme Court did say this. I'm just quoting again from Justice Roberts. He said, nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, otherwise. So I guess a black kid could say, you know, I grew up in Englewood. There were bullets flying everywhere. I lost a cousin. It was hard for me to survive, let alone get to where I am today, because I'm a black kid on the South Side. That's not a box checked, but that's a life story based on race, which they can consider, right?
Absolutely. So I think that's, and I think that's an important distinction, that the court has basically just said that it's no longer to be used the way it was being used for the last, I think, over maybe 20 or 30 years or so, where it's a box that's checked and then potentially, you know, ascribed a negative or a positive. And then the other problem is that this really is a zero-sum game. And the plaintiffs who brought this case were Asian American students who had very, very high SAT scores, very good grades, and were not being admitted to Ivy League schools that arguably they would have been admitted to had race not been an issue in the admissions process, if it were just a blind system.
But that seems a little almost counterintuitive, because when you do look at the University of Illinois, University of Chicago, Ivy League school, you see a lot of Asian kids. The point is there would be even more Asian kids there if we did not have these affirmative action admission policies, right?
Correct. That's correct. And then I think it opens up a discussion, a different discussion that might be a little bit uncomfortable, but the discussion there might be, why is it that there seems to be an academic skills gap between Asian Americans and white Americans and white Americans and minority Americans? What is it? Is it a cultural distinction? Is it, what exactly is going on there? And I think it's very uncomfortable for people to kind of to look into those issues. But I think eventually those issues are, we're going to need to look at those.
Well, then let's invest money in early childhood education. If you want to level the playing field, let's do it in the schools before the kids get to college and are competing based on merit more particularly. Because one of our teachers said, who called in yesterday, said he's got kids in his school who read at the third grade level and some that read in the 12th grade level in the same grade. That's the disparity that we need to pay attention to. But I will say this, Ray, that what everything you said here makes sense, is logical. I mean, I get it. But I think underlying this is the Supreme Court's assertion that the playing field is level now, that it should be all merit, that racism is no longer such an impediment in America that we need the courts or the laws to help level the playing field. And I just categorically reject that. I think racism is alive and well. There are disadvantages when you're a person of color. And I think the Supreme Court is sort of looking the other way at that.
Well, I think, John, even if you read Ketanya Jackson's dissent, she acknowledges that institutional legal racism is gone in the United States. So that is gone. But whether or not, you know, prejudices exist in the heart of man, that's something else. But I don't think that that's something that necessarily the courts are meant to address. That might be something culturally that we need to address. But I think the issue has to stay in terms of whether or not the admissions process was a constitutional one, not whether or not there should be some consideration of race. But I think we also have to kind of change with the times. The same necessity for the consideration of race that was necessary 30, 40 years ago certainly can't be said that that same level of consideration of race, or at least the same manner in considering race, should be applied today. So at least I think we can all agree that there should be some changes made to the system so that at least certain minorities are not being discriminated against in favor of other minorities, because I don't think that gets us anywhere either.
Well, that's where you get the reverse discrimination conversation, but I'm not with you completely on this, Ray. I will read what Justice Jackson said. She said, with let them eat cake obliviousness today, the majority pulls the ripcord and announces colorblindness for all by legal fiat. By deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life. And having so detached itself from this country's actual past and present experiences, the court has now been lured into interfering with the crucial work that the University of North Carolina and other institutions are doing to solve America's real-world problems. No one benefits from ignorance. Although formal race-linked legal barriers are gone, I think that's what you were talking about. Although formal race-linked legal barriers are gone, she writes, race still matters to the lived experiences of all Americans. Things are better, Ray, but I don't think they're fixed. I don't think they're level. And I guess the problem here is the court says, but that's not our business to fix.
Right, exactly. So I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you, because I don't think anybody can look at society and say that there are no racial issues or racial barriers for minorities to overcome, because that's clearly not true. It's just that the courts are there to address legal and institutional barriers that violate the Equal Protection Clause. Everything else, I think, is left up to us as a society to remedy. And so I think it was Justice Thomas in his opinion said that, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but basically everything cannot come down to race. There are disparities in life that are not due to race. So simply because there may be fewer of a particular minority group enrolled in college, that might not be because of their race or any kind of discrimination, certainly on the part of these schools. And I think we can show that the schools clearly do not intend to discriminate in a negative way against African-American students or other students. But what the Asian-American students in this case, in the plaintiff's case, were saying was that because it's a zero-sum game, there are only so many slots available that we're being discriminated against effectively because we're being viewed negatively based on our race. And again, race is something that we can't control. We have no control over our race. So really, when you think about it in those kinds of fairness terms, it is a tough case to make that some racial discrimination based on race is okay if it favors one group, but is negative towards another group.
I get that. And if I may, right? here is I think maybe what you were thinking about what Clarence Thomas said about these policies, and the Constitution should be colorblind. You know, all men are created equal, et cetera. Anyway, those policies fly in the face. He's talking about affirmative action. Those policies fly in the face of our colorblind Constitution and our nation's equality ideal. In short, they are plainly and boldly unconstitutional. Ray, can I ask you a question about student loans one more time?
Yes, of course.
One of our listeners said, both of my kids finished college during the pandemic and have not received any information about repayment of loans. What should they expect to happen now?
What they should expect to happen now is they should be getting an email or letter from their servicer. What I'm telling all of our clients to do, and especially in that situation, is to have your kids go to studentaid.gov. That's the site that's run by the Department of Education. They can create their own username and password, make sure they write down their username and password, and log in, and all of their federal loans will populate in there, and they can also see who the servicer is. So let's say the servicer is Mohila. Just go on to Mohila's website, create your account, and that way you should be able to tell exactly when your payment is and what kind of payment plan they may have automatically enrolled you in. And if it seems too high or it seems like something is off, obviously give us a call and we can help you out, or you can simply call your servicer. However, I will say that the servicers are really overburdened right now. They're processing millions of applications. They're trying to get caught up. So you may be on hold for 2-3 hours. Our staff is often on hold for 2 or 3 hours with the servicers. So it might be frustrating for a little while until everything kind of settles down.
It's good to talk to you, Ray. Thanks for your informed opinions about all of this and all of that other information about the loans. You can always click on Ray Kaplan's website. They've updated it, in fact, today, financialrelief.com. Nice to talk to you, Ray.
You too, John. Great talk today. Thanks so much.